Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point.
Members of Congress, the state of our union is strong.
That was what President Trump asserted last night in his State of the Union address. He ended with a call for unity, but that came more than an hour after a speech whose major hallmarks were the divisive themes that are gripping American politics.
In the past, most of the people in this room voted for a wall, but the proper wall never got built. I will get it built.
This hour on Point, the State of the Union and the state of this presidency. And you can join us. Did you watch President Trump's State of the Union address? What do you give the president credit for? What do you take issue with? And do you think his speech last night can bring the country together, as he asked in his closing paragraphs? And what's your response to Georgia gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams' Democratic response? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining us today from Washington is Shauna Thomas, Washington Bureau Chief for Vice News Tonight on HBO. Shauna, it's good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Michael Crowley, White House and National Security Editor for Politico. Michael, it's great to have you as well.
Very glad to be here. Thanks.
So let me just start by asking you both briefly, sort of what was your highlights from the President's State of the Union address? Shauna, what do you think?
I mean, I think the highlights were things that we kind of knew were already going to happen. I didn't find the State of the Union speech to be all that surprising. So his rhetoric about immigration and the wall was very similar to the things he's been saying for multiple years. I think everyone was a little bit surprised at him talking about, how low our unemployment is and how many jobs have been created. And that created this moment for many of the women in the House of Representatives, many who are Democrats, who all decided to wear white, the color of women's suffrage movement, to sort of stand up and cheer for themselves. I think he thought he was in on the joke on that one. I don't think he was part of what they were cheering about. But it did create this moment. And I think there was also the moment with the Holocaust survivor, who also was a survivor of the Tree of Life shooting at the synagogue, and everyone, and I think that moment was touching. But the takeaways people are going to have from this are all the things that we knew the president was going to talk about, which is he was going to talk about building the wall. He was going to talk about immigration and MS-13 and drugs on the border and people, coming over the border. And there would be some things about what he said there that are a little incorrect, and that he would talk about, our troops in Syria. But overall, I don't think anyone walked away from that speech thinking he had changed his tone about anything other than in a very superficial way after the Republicans took somewhat of a shellacking in the 2018 election, and that we have the same divisions that we had before.
Mm. Well, Michael, I'm going to get to you in a second here, but because Shauna mentioned several moments there, including when the Democratic women stood up and cheered, they were all wearing white, as Shauna said, as a sort of a nod to the suffragette movement. Let's just hear that moment that when they leapt to their feet to really cheer and congratulate themselves. The president said you weren't supposed to do that, but then he did give these new Democratic members of Congress their due.
Don't sit yet. You're gonna like this. And exactly one century after Congress passed the constitutional amendment giving women the right to vote, we also have more women serving in Congress than at any time before.
So, Michael, a moment of comedy there, a comity, I should say, not comedy, C-O-M-I-T-Y is what I mean.
A little both.
That's a little funny. Yeah.
But your highlights of the speech.
Well, my overall take is that the speech was kind of a scrambled egg. It's confusing. It's hard to analyze. Frankly, I don't think it was one of the great feats of speech writing. We were joking in the office last night that it you know, my reaction to it was a little bit like when a story comes in sometimes from a writer who maybe hasn't had enough time to meet their deadline, and the story is kind of a mess, we'll say. And, you know, what's this story trying to say? And what's the thesis of this story? And, you know, you start in one place and you go to another place, and it's hard for the reader to make sense of the point. And, you know, so for me, that was the defining quality of the speech. There was a call for unity and bipartisanship from a president who has practiced scorched earth political tactics for 2 years. And, you know, we all remember how he talked about the midterm elections and how caustic he was in talking about Democrats, and even literally hours before his speech, ways in which he was insulting Democrats. And then he went on in the same speech to hit, you know, very partisan, aggressive themes that and warning Democrats against investigating him, that really didn't suggest that he was going to deliver on any of that uplifting talk. But what I guess I thought was most striking to me, and our reporter Anita Kumar wrote this for Politico, and people can read it on our site, was, to me, you know, it was a president who, to some degree, is transitioning from pure insurgent to incumbent. So that for 2 years, Trump has been kind of railing against the established order and, you know, attacking the deep state and attacking everybody in Washington who's trying to stop him from making America great. But now, as he is, you know, halfway through his term and looking ahead to a reelection campaign, you hear him talking like an incumbent, trying to tout a record that I think will form the basis of his case for reelection. Now, of course, he's going to continue arguing for policies that he hasn't implemented, including this wall. But you see him, you know, compiling this list of economic growth statistics, job growth, wage growth. He's bragging about ending what he calls these senseless and endless foreign wars. He's bragging about having almost entirely destroyed ISIS. And it's interesting to me to hear him talking a little more like a traditional incumbent, because I think, last thing I'll say, he knows that, you know, to expand beyond his base that essentially just wants him to, you know, give him hell, so to speak, he's got to scoop up some of those moderate voters in the middle who want results. And at least in that first half of the speech, when he was talking about unity, bipartisanship, and getting things done, and his record, I think that's who he was talking to. And to me, that provides some insight into how he's thinking about his potential reelection campaign, a certain reelection campaign.
Yeah, so Shauna, pick up on that, because on the one hand, I think it may also be fair to say that, you know, State of the Union addresses have their moment for maybe 24 or 48 hours, and then by the time we hit Friday, people have moved on and forgotten about it. But on the other hand, to Michael's point, we've got a comment coming here on our website. Pete 18 says, "I think his speech last night demonstrates how easily Trump could win re-election if Democrats nominate someone on the far left with socialist tendencies." What do you think?
Well, I mean, he did try to set that, what Pete is talking about, up by specifically saying that this country is not a socialist country and we will never be a socialist country. So that is sort of setting up the frame of some of these people who are in this audience tonight are too far to the left. And I think the networks helped him out by having a cutaway of Bernie Sanders looking like Bernie Sanders and kind of gruff when he said that. But I also think, to your point about these speeches don't really last long, and on top of that, especially in kind of the news cycle that we currently have, they last even a shorter amount of time. People are going to take away from it what they want, and they can take away a message that the president is reaching out to Democrats and trying to find some way to have bipartisanship on infrastructure and prescription drugs. If that's the thing they wanted to hear from the speech, they can take away that he has the same rhetoric about immigrants coming over the border, if that's what you want to take away from the speech. And that's what Republicans and Democrats are going to do today. Right. The Democrats are going to tout the parts that speak to the President Trump that we've always heard. Republicans are going to say, hey, he's trying to work with y'all. The working with Democrats felt a little hollow. But to be honest, when presidents make these speeches, they all talk about unity and bipartisanship,
exactly,
especially after their party has lost an election right before. They talk about working together. They talk about some version of making America great. Those are standard lines in a State of the Union speech. And I sort of think we have to kind of shift those away and get back to, like, the things that he tried to flesh out. And the things he fleshed out in this speech, they weren't the things about, you know, prescription drugs, though, like HHS and other people are working on those things. They were the things about immigration. They were the things about not having, like, not being in wars forever.
Yeah.
They were things that are contentious. I also think it's worth pointing out that one of the things that stood out is what he didn't say. And while he did mention that we have this date of February 15th, when 25% of the government will once again run out of money, he didn't actually mention the furloughed workers
at all.
And that,
right.
At all. And And that was in contrast to Stacey Abrams made a big point about that. Now, one could say the Democrats won that shutdown argument and the Republicans did not. And the president, also thinking ahead to the election, doesn't want to highlight that. But because a lot of the Democratic members brought furloughed workers as their guests to the State of the Union, and because it was a real hardship for people, it was in some ways surprising he didn't mention that and didn't push even harder on this idea of working together to find a way to actually fund the Department of Homeland Security.
Well, I have to say, you know, your comment about how common the bromides about American greatness and American unity are in State of the Union addresses, I could not agree more. They are so common, they're starting to all blur together in my head, and I feel like we've reached a point where you could, like, make an internet State of the Union American greatness phrase generator, and we'd have that in
I'm sure there is a bot that has done it already, to be honest.
But but to get to your point, though, about the things that he did say, and didn't say, but did say specifically is where I think the meat of this speech was. And so let's just listen briefly to what the president described as the security situation on the southern border.
As we speak, large organized caravans are on the march to the United States. We have just heard that Mexican cities, in order to remove the illegal immigrants from their communities, are getting trucks and buses to bring them up to our country in areas where there is little border protection. I have ordered another 3,750 troops to our southern border to prepare for this tremendous onslaught.
Michael, we've got about 30 seconds to go before the break here, but I have to say, in that clip, what I heard was perfectly captured in a Politico headline today about Trump calls for unity on his terms.
Right, exactly. The bromides are there about unity, but the specifics really aren't. And by the way, he has been making the same points about a border wall for months now, and they are not breaking through. At some point, you just wonder, why is he wasting his breath? Everything he said about the wall was entirely familiar, and I don't think he's making further progress on it.
Yeah, well, we'll pick up that thought when we come back. We want to hear your reaction to President Trump's State of the Union address and Stacey Abrams' Democratic response last night as well. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're hearing reaction to President Donald Trump's State of the Union address from last night, and also reaction to the Democratic response, which was delivered by former Georgia gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams. Here's part of what she had to say.
Even as I am very disappointed by the president's approach to our problems, I still don't want him to fail. But we need him to tell the truth and to respect his duties and respect the extraordinary diversity that defines America.
That's Stacey Abrams in the Democratic response last night. I'm joined today by Shauna Thomas, Washington bureau chief for Vice News Tonight on HBO, and by Michael Crowley, White House and National Security editor for Politico. And let's get a couple of calls in here. Bill is calling from Naples, Florida. Bill, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thank you, everyone, for taking my call. I appreciate all your time. I have a quick question as far as, I know you all have briefly mentioned it, but is there something that in your expertise that he's saying that a lot of people in the audience don't see? We hear bipartisan. I think that's a great point. He only says this to, you know, showboat, so to speak, a little bit for the audience. But is there some lifelines that he's tossing out in the political world that are cues that only people in the Democratic audience understand? Okay, well, he is showing some lifeline he's tossing. We can work on that. Or is it just complete an utter stonewall?
Yeah, interesting question, Bill. Thank you for your call. Michael Crowley, what do you think? Hidden messages in the State of the Union to Democrats?
Well, I don't see it. It's an interesting question, you know, and a lot of political speak is in a certain kind of code. I didn't see it. But I would almost tackle the question a different way. I think the Democrats feel that after 2 years of dealing with Donald Trump, they just can't trust him. I think, you know, we're reaching a point where it almost doesn't matter what he says. They, you know, I think almost to a person, at least among elected Democrats in Congress, believe that Trump is a liar, frankly, and would just, you know, trample, you know, to take the old saying, you know, trample over his grandmother if that's what he had to do. That you do a deal with Donald Trump, you're going to regret it. He's gonna break it. He's gonna mischaracterize it. He's gonna turn around and attack you just when you least suspect it. So I didn't hear a specific kind of between the lines message. It may have been there, but I almost think, based on my understanding of what Democrats in Washington think about him right now, it kind of doesn't matter. He's basically lost them, and there's not a lot he can do about it.
Right. Well, let's hear a moment from the speech where the president was very direct, and I think it's one of the moments that really actually grabbed a lot of people's attention. It's when President Trump called on Congress to stop investigating him.
An economic miracle is taking place in the United States, and the only thing that can stop it are foolish wars, politics, or ridiculous partisan investigations. If there is going to be peace and legislation, there cannot be war and investigation. It just doesn't work that way.
That's President Trump there, mixing war and congressional investigations with peace and legislation. Shauna Thomas, this is the moment that grabbed my attention the most here, because I think the president was being absolutely direct in what he thinks about congressional investigations. I mean, and then making this claim that it could slow down American economic growth. What do you think?
I mean, I think it was a great use of a rhyming couplet, number one, and which means that we will all be playing that soundbite all day long. So in that way, he's getting his message out there. But even when he originally started into that point, when you watch the speech on television, the whole room didn't – it wasn't a half and half thing. It wasn't like a bunch of Republicans stood up and the Democrats sat down and applauded when he said these investigations are basically going too far and made the allusions that he made. It was a really tepid response in the room. And I think some of that comes from this idea that there are Republicans as well as Democrats in Congress who don't like the idea of the executive branch trying to take away the power that they have, one, to investigate, the power of oversight over the executive branch. And in some ways, even the appropriations conversation gets into that as well, in that one of the things Patrick Leahy said to me when he was walking into the original committee hearing for that group of people who's trying to come up with a way to fund the Department of Homeland Security was that, you know, it is Congress who controls the purse strings, and it is Congress who will decide how this money gets spent. So I think some of that came – while I do think there are Republicans who wish this investigation thing would wrap up – part of that was about don't take away the power that we have as Congress to investigate whatever the heck we want to investigate. But I also think, you know, the president has said he doesn't like the investigations. He doesn't appreciate it. He thinks they are going too far. And him expressing that once again and trying to put it in the context of something that people outside of Congress will take away from it, which is what are we not getting done because we're investigating, makes a lot of sense. However, it's not just Congress investigating the president, as you and all of your listeners know. Even if the president was able to convince everyone in that room to shut down the House Intelligence Committee, the House and Senate Judiciary Committee, the Senate Intelligence Committee, and everyone else, you would still have Robert Mueller. So it was interesting to use this venue to so forcefully talk about that mm-hmm. and call attention to it. But it doesn't change anything.
If I can just jump down and make a very quick point, it takes me back to that last caller's question, which is, you know, that's almost the inverse of what the caller was saying. To the extent that Trump's position, and he made this clear before and after the midterms, is that if the Democrats aggressively exercise their oversight powers and investigate him, you know, there can be no deal making, there can be no bipartisanship. I mean, that is just a dead letter. Like, Democrats are absolutely not going to walk away from the, you know, dozen plus subjects they feel they have an urgent need to investigate. And so to the extent he's taking that position, it's a complete non-starter on every other front.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things that a lot of people thought of as well, we've got a comment here from N. Steph saying, President Richard Nixon also used the State of the Union to complain about investigations in 1974. Michael Crowley. I think a lot of people sort of had that in long political memory about that moment as well. Yeah. I mean, I was just going to say, leading up to the fact that Nixon resigned 6 months later. But.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, you know, it was potentially easy as you get kind of caught, if we get caught up in the sub themes and what are the messages here and what are the, he's talking about prescription drugs and, oh, it's interesting what he said about Afghanistan, to forget that, you know, the walls are closing in on this guy big time, as he would say, right? I mean, this is a president who has had a series of people extremely close to him be indicted or even sentenced to prison time. The investigations are multiplying. His inaugural committee is now in the crosshairs. Michael Cohen is going up to the Hill to testify on Friday to the Intelligence Committee. This is a guy who's in really big trouble, and Democrats feel a duty and a responsibility to get to the truth. That's the noble part of it. And B, really smell blood in the water and think that this could be Richard Nixon. And man, they're not going to hold back after the way Trump has treated them for 2 years.
Yeah. And I also think that, I mean, just to give Republicans their due on the Hill, I do think there are Republicans who think it is their duty to try to figure out what actually happened during the 2016 election as well. Mm-hmm. And I think we've seen that with Richard Burr and the Senate Intelligence Committee, and that people have been trying to investigate this to various degrees of success on the Hill. I mean, you also have a president who spoke last night, but today the House Intelligence Committee is going to vote on whether to release their transcripts to Robert Mueller. And a lot of the people on the House Intelligence Committee on the Democratic side have hinted that multiple people could have possibly lied to them, and that if, you know, Mueller is able to look at their transcripts as well as the conversations he's had, you have a situation where other people close to the President Trump may have a problem with lying to Congress, which is a federal offense.
Yeah. Let's go to Will, who's calling from Greenville, South Carolina. Will, you're on the air.
Hi, I have a comment. We often hear that from President Trump and his supporters that Democrats are for open borders. But then last night, we simultaneously hear this message that many in the House and Senate have voted for the wall in the past, but they won't now because they hate President Trump. So you have two conflicting narratives. There's a glaringly obvious cognitive dissonance, and Trump and his supporters seem to be able to handle that cognitive dissonance. So it's just a comment about that. You can't have both. You can't have Democrats are for open borders and Democrats have voted for the wall in the past.
Well, Will, thank you for your call. Michael Crowley, let me just dovetail a little bit with what Will is saying here. I always wonder why it seems as if Democrats don't push back harder against this assertion from the president and other members of the Republican Party that the Democrats are for open borders. I mean, there's nothing open about the southern border at all of the United States. And so, you know, is this an opportunity that Democrats are missing in order to more fully assert what their policies are for immigration? Or are they just sort of not wanting to engage in the language of open borders?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, it's possible that on some level it just it's such a preposterous charge that they don't want to engage with it. It's such a kind of over the top thing to say. You know, I think, and then I think Democrats also feel, you know, even if they are making a case for, you know, very mainstream positions involving, you know, border security and enforcement, you know, they're under a lot of pressure from a liberal base that thinks that even the center of the Democratic Party is kind of been caught up in conservative calls for extreme border security and limitations on immigration. So I think that they are wary of kind of being drawn into a position where they're responding to something like that and saying, no, you know, we are very tough. And then their base is getting very upset and saying, you know, why are you playing along with this game that we hate so much? So they're in a little bit of a tough position. But I think probably the baseline issue is that it is just such an over the top claim. And you can't really respond to everything Trump says like that.
I mean, Shauna, it may be over the top, but also it's one of those it's like a political phrase that depending on who you are, you can impart any meaning you want into it. Right. And so I wonder if, again, I just come back to this idea, are Democrats missing an opportunity to tell, you know, people who might be in the center who have concerns about immigration, like, no, this specifically, fill in the blank, is what we stand for.
Well, I think in some ways what you're hitting on is this idea that a lot of the immigration policy that we seem to hear that seems to bubble up from Democrats, at least right now, is about being anti-Trump, being anti what the president is saying about it. And it is unclear currently, though we may get some more clarity, what exactly it is that if you talk to the Democratic Party internally and sort of pushed away the Republicans, what they stand for when it comes to immigration. Mm-hmm. And what Michael was, you know, highlighting is that that base of people who seemed to sort of respond to the call to abolish ICE before 2018 and that kind of thing, the Democrats are trying to grapple with what that means for their party, what they stand for, and what it is when they are not just anti-Trump. And I think that message has gotten a little bit muddled. But in some ways, because President Trump's message is so strident and so clear about immigration, they almost don't need to grapple with it yet. But what I'm hearing from you, and in some ways what I'm hearing from your callers, they need to figure out what they stand for other than being anti the president.
Right. And to link back to what you were both saying earlier, I mean, going into another presidential election cycle, the imperative for that, I think, becomes even greater. Let's go to Jerry, who's calling from Detroit, Michigan. Jerry, you're on the air.
Hello. This is my first time calling On Point.
Welcome, Jerry. We're glad you did.
I was going to bring up 3 points, but since you're trying to get the callers through, I'm just going to bring up 2 at the moment.
Okay.
First, Donald Trump and the white community still trying to take credit for low black and Hispanic unemployment. And I think the hypocrisy, I'm black, by the way, of the white community to complain about Donald Trump being picked on, about the Democrats being anti-Trump when the Republicans have been anti-Obama. Mm. It seems to me there's this sort of hypocrisy, a sort of selective amnesia, if you will, when I hear Republicans, especially white people, when they complain about how demonized and picked on Donald Trump is, when it was these same, dare I say, racist white people from whom Barack Obama caught holy hell from. And as far as the low black unemployment, that was really under Barack Obama. Donald Trump is simply trying to take credit for that. And I was, if I do have time.
Yeah, just a couple seconds, Jerry. Go ahead.
Remember back when during the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, mm-hmm. during Donald Trump's 60-second photo op at the King Memorial in Washington, D.C., I still question whether or not Dr. King was every bit as much of a hero and an inspiration to white people as he has been to black people, because I listen all the time when I listen to white people invoke and quote Martin Luther King all the time. And I don't think Dr. King was any hero to white people.
Yeah. Well, Jerry, I'm going to take it back from you. And thank you so much for your call. That's Jerry from Detroit. Shauna Thomas, talk to me about what you heard Jerry say. I mean, I'm particularly interested in Jerry taking issue with the president, President Trump, taking credit for unemployment, the current lower unemployment rates amongst African-Americans and Latinos in America.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that comes out in the fact checks is that when President Trump says it's the lowest unemployment rates for African Americans and Latinos currently, it is true. It is a good headline for the president. It is great in the world of Twitter, which the president lives in, to be able to tout that. But the nuance of it is that, you know, no one president is responsible for the economic situation that we are in, that the unemployment rate was going down for everybody as well as specific, you know, minority groups since Barack Obama was in office and since he left office. So this is the economy moves in certain directions. And, you know, some of that is President Obama's doing. Some of that is President Trump's doing. But the thing is, all presidents kind of try to take credit for the good.
Exactly.
And then also try to, like, ignore the bad and ignore the fact that a lot of the jobs that have been created recently are not, you know, high skill, high wage jobs. They are service industry jobs. And in grappling with that nuance is one hard to do in a speech like the one the president gave last night.
Yeah.
But also, it's hard for anyone to understand unless you really have the time.
Well, Shauna Thomas and Michael Crowley, hang on here for just a second. We are listening to reaction to the president's State of the Union address last night and to Stacey Abrams' Democratic response as well. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about reaction to President Donald Trump's State of the Union address last night. Shauna Thomas and Michael Crowley are with us this hour. Let's hear another moment from the address when the president talked about the United States and North Korea.
As part of a bold new diplomacy, we continue our historic push for peace on the Korean Peninsula. Our hostages have come home. Nuclear testing has stopped. And there has not been a missile launch in more than 15 months. If I had not been elected president of the United States, we would right now, in my opinion, be in a major war with North Korea.
President Donald Trump last night. Michael Crowley, I think the president saves himself with the caveat of, in my opinion. But people were quite taken aback by the president claiming that the U.S. would be in a major war with North Korea had it not been for him.
Yeah, well, you know, that was Trump being Trump. I don't know that anyone takes it. Well, let me put it this way. I don't know that people who, you know, have the professional mandate or the luxury and time to follow foreign policy closely, I think very few people agree with that. I think that a lot of low information American voters who may find North Korea policy confusing and don't know a lot about it might not know any better. And so, number one, the point is, I think that that's a hard statement to defend.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, I do think that there's something interesting going on with Trump's foreign policy. And again, it speaks to this question of him trying to cultivate a record as a successful incumbent looking at 2020, which is that, you know, people in the 2016 campaign and through the first 2 years of his presidency have been very afraid that he might lash out, you know, pick a fight, start a war. There's action in Congress to try to make it harder for him to order a launch of nuclear weapons. And I think there are plenty of defensible arguments for the idea that Trump is rash and quick to anger and you know, may make risky foreign policy decisions. Having said all that, he is withdrawing troops from Syria. He does want to get us out of Afghanistan. He is meeting with the leader of North Korea. He kind of manufactured a crisis around North Korea a year or two ago. You know, he sort of was talking about a war with North Korea and got everyone really scared. But then he de-escalated. There's a phrase, you can escalate to de-escalate. And I actually think he did that successfully. So, you know, I guess I'm really talking about kind of political messaging and optics here, which is perhaps less important than the substance. At the same time, I do think it speaks to his ability to get reelected, which is a very important question. And I do think that he has built himself a nice set of talking points to say, you know, people said I was a warmonger, but that's not what's happening. And I'm trying to get to have peace break out everywhere. Mm-hmm. And he has some real data points behind that. And it's going to be confounding for the 2020 Democrats, who I think actually agree with him on a lot of this stuff, to come after him on foreign policy. So I'm going to be so interested to see how that plays out politically.
Yeah, I just wanted to tell Michael that I think that he's exactly right on that point, that there is a bipartisan coalition of Americans out there who, you know, would agree with the president about America's involvement in, quote, endless wars. The question is sort of how to bring those involvements to a satisfactory close. There's major differences of opinion on that. But Shauna, go ahead.
No, I also think kind of what Michael is speaking about shows some of, and this is going to sound crazy to some of your listeners, but some of the consistency of President Trump.
Right.
In that, just like his immigration comments have been very consistent since 2016, his desire to be non-interventionist, to pull troops out of some of the wars that we are in the Middle East, to bring troops home, to try to figure out a new way to deal with Kim Jong-un in North Korea. And in this case, it's actually meeting face-to-face and apparently again in Vietnam later this month, is the exact same things he was talking about during the election. And there is a messaging thing there for him in 2020 that might be helpful in that, even though, you know, we probably won't have all of our troops out of Afghanistan by the time we get to our election in 2020. He does get to say, hey, this is what I said in 2016. I have consistently said it up through the election, up through the midterms. I am still saying it and I am still working towards that. And, you know, you may not agree with what he wants to do or how he says it. And his style has definitely turned off a lot of our allies, especially in Europe. But he does have somewhat of a consistency of message that could help him.
Yeah. Well, Shauna Thomas, Washington bureau chief for Vice News Tonight on HBO, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Michael Crowley, White House and National Security Editor for Politico. Michael, it was great to have you. Thank you as well.
Always a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
And folks, you can continue to send us your comments about your reaction to the President's State of the Union Address. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook, as always, at onpointradio. Now, we want to shift gears here for a moment and talk about something else that President Trump said that we believe is worthy of extra attention. It was on Sunday in an interview with CBS's Face the Nation.
I'm not leaving. We have a base in Iraq, and the base is a fantastic edifice. I mean, I was there recently and I couldn't believe the money that was spent on these massive runways and I've rarely seen anything like it. And it's there and will be there.
The president was referring to Al Asad Air Force Base in Iraq's Anbar province. Now, Trump caused a stir when he seemed to suggest he'd use the base to watch Iran rather than assist Iraqis in fighting the Islamic State. So we thought it's time to take a closer look at the Al-Asad base and its strategic importance in the region, along with other U.S. military installations throughout the Middle East. So let's turn now to Laura Seligman in Washington. She's Pentagon correspondent for Foreign Policy magazine. Laura, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. So first of all, tell us a little bit more about the Al-Asad Air Force Base. I think it's a base that most Americans haven't thought about in years, even though some form of American military installation has been there since the Iraq War. Is that right?
Yes, that is exactly right. It's important to go through sort of the history of the base. So it was actually built by Saddam Hussein, and the U.S. used it extensively in Operation Iraqi Freedom in the Iraq War. So they came in 2003. They spent about $300 million updating the base. In fact, it was actually called Camp Cupcake because of all the amenities, swimming pools, gyms, a Burger King, that kind of thing. So it was used extensively during that operation. Then it was turned over back to the Iraqis in 2011 with the drawdown. But then a couple years later, the base was actually overrun by the Islamic State. And in 2014, 2015, the Iraqi government invited us back in to help fight the Islamic State. So today, this is actually one of the largest U.S. military hubs in Iraq, but it's mostly used for logistics and training of the Iraqi security forces. The exact number and makeup of U.S. forces there is classified, but we likely are trying to keep the footprint relatively small. It's unlikely we have a fighter jet squadron there, for example, although we did add a couple hundred troops in there in 2016 to prepare for the Battle of Mosul. The important thing is to remember is that they're explicitly for the counter-ISIS mission, not to, quote, watch Iran.
Right. So we'll talk more about that in a moment because it's vitally important here. But I'm also seeing that the base is it currently the headquarters of the 7th Division of the Iraqi Army? And is there an Iraqi infantry training school there?
There is also an Iraqi presence there as well.
Okay.
It's joint Iraqi and U.S.
I see. Okay. So then tell us more about what you were just saying, that its primary mission is to fight against the Islamic State here. And it seems as if efforts out of Al-Asad base have been rather successful recently in Iraq.
Yes, yeah, that's true. So Al-Asad is in Anbar province, as you know, in Iraq. This is sort of a large and desert-like area, largely unpopulated, and the people that are there are mainly Sunnis. So this is sort of the perfect ground for ISIS to come in, and since many of these Sunnis are disenfranchised when Saddam was removed from power and a Shia government came in to rule the country, many of these residents became disenfranchised and then turned to ISIS for support or even to join them. And so it's sort of a perfect place for the U.S. to be to launch attacks out of, to train Iraqi security forces there to fight ISIS. It's also important to note here that, as you know, U.S. military plans in the region are pretty fluid,
mm-hmm.
but officially there has been no change in the mission. General Votel, the commander of U.S. Central Command, said yesterday before the Senate that the mission in Iraq and Al-Asad Air Base has not changed. We have not shifted from counter-ISIS to watching Iran. However, just like in Syria, being there is one more place from which we can pressure Iran indirectly, symbolically, just by being there. But also, it's a base for aircraft or surveillance aircraft, special operations forces, who can survey Iranian activity in Syria in particular. Obviously, we're not allowed to overfly Iran.
Right. Well, I mean, you mentioned the aircraft there here. And just to harken back for a moment to what the president said in that clip that we played at the top of our conversation, he was very impressed with, quote, the massive runways here. And they are massive. They're 14,000 feet, 13,000 feet long, respectively. The entire perimeter of the base I'm reading here is 24 kilometers long. So it's a huge installation here. But to talk more specifically, as we should, about why what the president said on Sunday, why it upset the Iraqis in particular, let's listen to more of what President Trump said to CBS's Margaret Brennan about his plans at the moment, for U.S. troops in Iraq.
You're keeping troops in Iraq because you want to be able to strike in Iran?
No, because I want to be able to watch Iran. All I want to do is be able to watch. We have an unbelievable and expensive military base built in Iraq. It's perfectly situated for looking at all over different parts of the troubled Middle East, rather than pulling up. And this is what a lot of people don't understand. We're going to keep watching, and we're going to keep seeing. And if there's trouble, if somebody's looking to do nuclear weapons or other things, we're going to know it before they do.
That's President Donald Trump on CBS's Face the Nation on Sunday. Now, Laura, I think we should talk about why, as you pointed out, there's been no formal change in mission for U.S. troops at operating out of al-Asad Air Force Base here. But the Iraqis were very upset, though, at the president even suggesting that perhaps the primary mission of the base at some time in the future would be to, quote, watch Iran. So tell us more about why the Iraqis were so upset.
Yeah, so this is an interesting point. Obviously, U.S. forces in Iraq are one of the indirect missions is to sort of watch and pressure Iran. But this isn't something that the Iraqi government necessarily wanted to be highlighted out in the public, and it presents a lot of problems for them diplomatically. The Iraqi government has never authorized a counter-Iran mission, and that is particularly sensitive for them. They're majority Shia. There are lots of trade and cultural and family ties to Iran. So now that the president has actually said this and put this in the public sphere, the Iraqi government is looking to push back. In fact, in the parliament, there are some measures being considered that may try to kick U.S. forces out or otherwise put some restrictions on the movements of U.S. forces. And this is all coming about because the president has highlighted this in a way that the Iraqis don't want it to be highlighted.
Now, I'm seeing reports here that senior military officials, U.S. military officials, have recently visited several Iraqi bases, including Erbil and al-Asad, as we're talking about. You know, I guess they're thinking about, you know, future troop deployments as and when the United States fully withdraws from Syria. So let's, like, just for a minute here, Laura, let's zoom out the camera here and talk about American military installations in the region. I would presume that there are enough of them such that no matter what the mission is, the military is going to be well positioned to do things like watch Iran or, as you were mentioning, keep an eye on Syria, even if aircraft cannot fly over Syrian airspace.
Yes, I think that's definitely true. One of the things that is happening as the U.S. withdraws forces from Syria is that these forces are actually getting moved to some of these bases in Iraq. And I think the president spoke about that publicly, the redeployment of some of these troops to elsewhere in Iraq. But another thing they're considering is keeping a small presence at a base called Al-Tanf, a very small remote base in southeast Syria. Quite far away from the fight that the U.S. Has been doing with the Kurds in the northeast against ISIS across this sort of deconfliction line we've had with Russia and the Syrian regime, very close to the Jordanian border. And the important thing about this base is that it is on a very potentially important Iranian supply route through Jordan and Syria to Lebanon. And then obviously from Lebanon, they can threaten Israel. So this, unlike Assad, Al-Tanf is actually geographically, strategically important to Iran. Yeah. And so keeping a U.S. presence there allows us to keep an even closer eye. Obviously, Syria shares a border with Iran in a way that Iraq does not. And so this is one of the things that we're looking at potentially doing to another way to keep a close eye on Iran.
We've got about 30 seconds left here, Laura. I mean, what's the balance between ending the quote unquote endless wars that President Trump talks about, Afghanistan, Iraq, et cetera, and the maintenance of massive U.S. military facilities in these countries? Will we ever have an end to these endless wars for as long as millions and millions of dollars and U.S. troops are on the ground there?
Well, it's important to remember that the U.S. has a presence of large presence globally. We still have troops in Germany and Korea. So we actually do maintain U.S. forces sort of around the world at these installations. In the Middle East in particular, it actually is kind of difficult and requires a lot of logistics and more people to take people away that are already there than it would be just leaving them. So we actually have to spend money to withdraw from Syria. So, you know, on balance, you have to realize that part of this is that the U.S. does keep a global presence all over to watch our enemies and fight terrorists and make sure we can project power.
Well, Laura Seligman, Pentagon correspondent for Foreign Policy Magazine, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.